audio service, National Radio Club.
From the transmitter room of WNRC, we'd like to welcome you to the National Radio Club's DX audio service for September 2003. This is issue number 222, and I'm your host, Fred Vobey, the publisher of the DX audio service. Our address is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number is 419-228-6223. And if you're on the internet, you can send me email at fredv, that's F-R-E-D-V, at nrcdxas.org. If you live in the United States of America and would like to become a member of the DX audio service, the subscription cost is $28. To members in Canada, the subscription rate is $32. And to Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Those prices are also the renewal rates. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep the cassettes. If you'd like to subscribe, make a check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me the address I just mentioned, or just log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org/member and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. Well, in just a few seconds, I got to go take base current readings and see what the antenna system looks like. So we'll let Jerry Starr entertain you with call letter changes and switches, because the column is known as the AM Switch.
Hi, everybody. Jerry Starr with another edition of AM Switch from the pages of the National Radio Club's DX News magazine. For September, reference number 564 begins with these call letter changes on 650. Brand new station in Pullman, Washington will be KUUX. 790 KPTO in Winchester, Nevada. Another brand new station will not go on the air with that call. They will be KBET. Probably a better call for the Las Vegas area. 1150 WBPS in Boston, Massachusetts, changing calls again, this time to WYTS. On 1250 WUGR, Nicholasville, Kentucky, becomes WWFT. 1380 WLXE, New York, New York, becomes WKDM. We'll get to the other half of that swap when we get to 1600. 1400 WFFL in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, changes to WFLL. 1440 KBET in Pocatello, Idaho becomes KPTO. 1490 WBYM Hampton, Virginia changes to WLRT. 1570, that new station in Winterville, North Carolina will be WECU. And on 1600 WKDM in Rockville, Maryland becomes WLXE. Three new stations have been applied for on 780 in Pueblo, Colorado, on 830 in Sandy Springs, Georgia. Actually, that's an amendment to an existing application. And on 890 in Fountain, Colorado. One new station has been granted north of the border in Laval, Quebec, on 1570, 10,000 watts day and night, different patterns day and night. Two applications of interest, also north of the border on 1250, CBGA in Matane, Quebec, wants to move to 102.1 FM. And on 1360, CKBC in Bathurst, New Brunswick, wants to move to 104.9. One grant of interest on 1690 WHTE in Johnston City, Illinois. They will be moving their City of Lights to Berwyn, Illinois. This is a move of almost 300 miles, which will give the Chicago market its first X-band station. WDDD-FM will move to Johnston City, so there will be a local station when WDDD-810 leaves the air because of the five-year rule. WHTE 1690 was their X-band station. All this arranged by your friendly folks at Clear Channel. Taking a look at otherness on 590 WRAG in Carrollton, Alabama, this silent station has returned to the air. 700 application for a new station in Bosque Farms, New Mexico has been dismissed. 920 KWYS West Yellowstone, Montana has returned to the air. 1230 WWSD Quincy, Florida is silent. 1260 KIMB in Kimball, Nebraska is back on the air. 1400 KIGO St. Anthony, Idaho. This silent station has returned back to the air on this frequency to keep the license active while the new 1420 facility is being built. And on 1460 KTFW in Burleson, Texas, this new station has been testing these facilities since their move from Waco and is expected to be on the air soon. And that wraps it up for this month. 30 days from now, I'll be back with my very final edition of AM Switch as we move into retirement, and a gentleman named Bill Hale will be taking over for us. But for right now, let's go back to the same old guy. Here's John Bowker in Travelogue.
National Radio Club.
Well, thanks once again, Jerry, and hello, everybody. Today, we're going to continue our travels with our radio dials locked at 810 kilohertz in the central and the western part of the United States. So, with nothing more to say, let's get started on the travelogue for this month. Now, if you'll recall, we left off in August in Tennessee, so now we're going to move up into the east central part of Kentucky as we begin the September 2003 DX Audio Service travelogue.
Taking a look at that weather forecast for Breathitt and surrounding counties this Labor Day Monday. Partly sunny today, high 85 to 90.
You're listening to 810 WEKG AM and Stereo 106.5 WJSN FM, Intermountain Broadcasting Company, Jackson.
CNN Radio News, I'm David Hull. There is no let-up in the verbal exchange between Washington and Baghdad.
Now, that recording in eastern Kentucky was made the day we were leaving and on our way home from the Bridgeport, West Virginia National Radio Club Convention about 3-4 years ago. Great time there, too. The station runs 1,000 watts. It's non-directional, daytime only, I see, from the NRC log. And as I look at the atlas around Jackson, there's very little there, so those people enjoy good radio, at least. That's great. Now, driving just a couple of hours to the west from there, you enter America's heartland. Indianapolis, Indiana is our next target city. And this recording was made in 1973.
Alive with the sound of beautiful music. WATI 810, Indianapolis.
Now WATI News, reported by Sam Wade.
Well, that takes us back to an early Gates 250-watt transmitter. And the way that that station covered the required metropolitan area of Indianapolis with a non-directional antenna was by locating it right downtown. Of course, they didn't get out to the outskirts very far. But anyway, by 1989, we tuned to 810 as we once again entered Indianapolis. And we heard their change of call letters and their change of format, too.
WGRT. Instant inspiration.
By the middle 1990s, they had taken on yet a new sound and identity.
Hi, this is Ozzy the Cat, and I've got just four words for you. I love the Pacers. You're listening to Radio Oz on AM 810 WSYW Indianapolis.
And when Radio Oz failed, what do you suppose they did? Well, Scott Feibusch answered that question just last year with this next recording. That station still operates with just 250 watts right now to this very day, and they remain a daytime-only operation. But if we leave Indiana and just drive a half hour to the west, we come to Johnston City, Illinois.
This is Fox Sports Radio 810, WDDD-AM, Johnston City, Maryland, a clear channel radio station.
And as you heard from Jerry, WDDD's days are limited now, so I'm glad we have that on tape. Well, okay, we were on our way up into Wisconsin to the town of Dodgeville, and we picked up this 250-watt daytimer.
With Honky Tonkin' Fool on Hit Kickin' Country, WDMP, AM and Stereo FM, Dodgeville, Mineral Point, and serving Boscobel, Wisconsin on our translator station. Right now it's 4 o'clock and time for news.
Yes, indeed. Dodgeville. It's a half-hour drive due west of Madison and next to the House on the Rock. No, we'd never heard of that either, but we spent nearly a whole day there. But we did break away finally to head north to visit Mike Dukin the following day. He was on the air at a big FM station up in his
his home area. By the way, Mike, you know that was 10 years ago? Good grief. But while in that part of northern Wisconsin, we taped this next ID on yet another day timer. Only this station operates with 980 watts during the day.
Coming up next, we'll check in with our CBS News update from New York on WJJQ, AM and FM Tomahawk. We'll take a look at local news along with sports and temperature at 58 degrees and cloudy. News update next.
CBS News, this is David Jackson.
Okay, and next we come to one of those unexplained station swaps that now are getting to be a little more common. Kansas City, with a wide-reaching signal at 810 on the dial, you wonder why they or any buyer would make a major identity change in the station, you know, and risk the confusion of the listeners. But they did. Now, here's how they sounded back in 1990 when Mike Smith recorded this station.
Nice things happen to people who listen to KCMO, Kansas City, Missouri.
Evening, 6 o'clock, 83 degrees in Kansas City. Bill Kennedy with KCMO Radio News up to the minute.
KCMO, what great call letters. Then in 1997, with considerable fanfare, the station that had been operating at 710 on the dial, that's WHB, and KCMO, were sold to different owners, who promptly swapped their dial positions. That meant the 50,000-watt transmitter at the 810 dial position went over to WHB, and the 10,000-watt transmitter, the lesser transmitter, went to KCMO down at 710 on the dial. Now, the two antenna patterns, according to the NRC Night Pattern Book, are virtually identical in shape and distance, with the exception that the 710 station does reach into the western suburbs of Kansas City much better than now does WHB. Now, here's how they sounded to Mark Durenberger at 810 on the dial when he recorded WHB for us just 3 years ago.
Until tomorrow at 6 a.m. local time, everybody. This is Scott. Peace. On the streets.
WHB, Kansas City.
Sports Fan Radio Network.
Well, okay, we move now into the Lone Star State to take a listen to radio in the San Antonio area at 810 kilohertz. Now, this is another 250-watt station, only this one operates not only with a directional antenna system to get more oomph into downtown San Antonio, but they use a different pattern during the day and at night. In fact, with that many towers, they have more power going into the lighting of their tower system than they have coming out of their transmitter.
Ladies, nasty.
KSJL San Antonio, KCHG Somerset.
We were listening there to the AM side of their programming. That's KCHG. Now, out in the central western part of Texas, up in the hilly mountainous terrain, lies the town of Crane, Texas.
XOI, Crane, Odessa, Midland. Sky, he's OE, Crane, Odessa, Midland. La nueva radio alabanza. Atención, Lisa. Ya abrió sus puertas el Michoacano.
Yep, not far from the Mexican border either. Okay, now, from there all the way up through Oklahoma and Kansas and Nebraska, there's just nothing at 810 to bring to you until we get out to the western part of South Dakota near the Badlands, where we find a station operating with, you ready, 25,000 watts during daylight hours.
Five-state radio KBHB and all hit country KRCS Sturgis and Rapid City. 5 minutes before 10, let's get back to the top 30 countdown for the final four.
The weekly top 30 with Armin and Devin.
Now, at night, they reduce their power a bit to 60 watts. Mark Strickert made that catch for us back in 1992 on one of his vacation trips out of Chicago. Now, right after the NRC convention that was hosted by Wayne and Joan Heinen in Aurora, Colorado a few years back, Linda and I made this recording of the 810 station while passing through the town of Rifle, Colorado.
The widest variety of country for the Roaring Fork and Grand Valleys. KRGS, Rifle, Glenwood Springs.
Baby, close that suitcase. Let's turn this thing around.
Now, this next recording shows you something new about Mark Durenberger, just how lucky he is. You see, for 3 years, I recorded this station for hours, just waiting for a station break. And, of course, no luck. But then, along comes Mark, goes through Santa Fe, New Mexico, probably at 55, 65 miles an hour, and bang, on that one shot, they give him an ID right off the bat.
Somos KSW AM 81, la voz bilingüe en el Gran Suroeste. Radio que suave de la comunidad, Santa Fe, Nuevo México.
Good morning, it's 8 o'clock, time now for AM 81 News, a presentation of Community Bank.
Well, thanks, Mark. I don't know if I'll really ever get out that way again, so you've saved that station for the collection very nicely. And now we come to one of the giants on this frequency, the West Coast's biggie on 810.
KGO, News Talk 810. If you're talking about it, we're talking about it. KGO, San Francisco, San Jose, Oakland.
KGO, News Talk 810.
From ABC News, I'm Joan Bennett. The House says no to a measure that would have ended affirmative action in public college admissions.
Let's do that once more so you'll hear the jingle.
This is ABC.
Of the Cal Bears, KGO San Francisco.
Okay, now, out in the middle of the state of Washington is the city of Ephrata, pretty much at the hub of a three-city marketing area.
This is the American Christian Network. American Christian Network affiliates are KSPO, Dishman, Spokane, Coeur d'Alene, KTBI, Ephrata, Moses Lake, Wenatchee, KGDN, Pasco, Richland, Kennewick,
KYAK, Yakima, KTAC, Ephrata, Moses Lake, and KGER, Quincy, Wenatchee.
Pete Taylor picked up that clean and complete ID for us 2 or 3 years ago. I've always been interested that the management of those stations would operate KTBI and Ephrata as sort of a keynote station. They're 50,000 watts, but they're daytime only. And all the other stations you heard on that ID are on day and night. So, well, now, just before we leave you today, I know I told you last month that the Puerto Rican station on 810 beamed its signal south, but that never bothered Scott Feibusch. He just went where he had to go to get this nice, if not complicated, station break from them.
La hora en la M81.
12:59.
Al servicio de la comunidad, la fe y la cultura, esta es
AM81. WKBM, San Juan, Puerto Rico.
Radiodifusora Católica de la Arquidiócesis de San Juan.
La frecuencia nacional de Puerto Rico.
Well, as you can understand, Linda and I are on the road as you receive this tape of the September DX audio service programs. We'll be attending the Dallas Convention with any luck. Dallas is an exciting city, and, you know, it's just great to spend a few days with so many of our old and new friends in the National Radio Club and the DX audio service. What do you say, maybe next year? Okay, meantime, let's join Mark Durenberger once again.
This is the DX audio service.
Mark Durenberger on the road again, and we are in Cincinnati, Ohio, with Paul Jellison at WLW, going through that historic transmitter plant. And today, we tour the 500,000-watt transmitter on the air in the mid-30s on WLW.
Big, wide steel staircase.
Yes.
Oh, my word.
This is the...
Oh, my goodness.
This is the transmitter that I think caused Hitler to call Powell Crosley the liar of Cincinnati, because he could hear it over there and didn't like what was being said about him.
I'm speechless, which for me is really something.
It is a rather impressive piece. The place is very clean. It's been well kept, and I want to, every time chance I can get, to thank the Harris Corporation. For two weekends, they had probably 15 or 20 employees out here on a Saturday cleaning this place up. The amount of manpower that we got because this place was just covered with junk, and I vowed to not let that happen again.
Right.
But it is just incredible the way this place looks. I mean, they armor-alled the front of the cabinet, and I mean, they really did a great job.
Well, the cabinet, ladies and gentlemen, consists of in a macro sense, it's a huge black box. It looks like it's about 50 feet wide and maybe 20 feet high. Huh?
Yeah, I think 56 feet.
Now, this was an RCA design, a GE build, and a Westinghouse control.
Westinghouse did the controls, and I think they might have done the transformers. You're right. RCA was the prime contractor, and GE was involved as well. So you'll see basically the big, what I call the big three, hands were on this unit.
Is this the same one that RCA decided to build several of, which ended up at the Aspidistra project in Great Britain during the war, do you think? I know they had a bunch. They were going to build some because they thought this country was going to go superpower.
Well, you know, that could be. I don't know. I don't know about that. That's interesting. Yeah. That's the first I've heard of that. But yeah.
This was a beta site, maybe, for a 500,000-watt transmitter.
Gee, sounds like...
Here you go again.
Sounds like history all over again, doesn't it?
Now, I'm also told that RCA, in its wisdom, built this thing in a series of blocks, so one could fail.
Yes, and yes, they are. This transmitter is modular. They were in series, which current understanding of doing things like that seems highly unusual to put items in series. You normally parallel things. But yes, they are redundant. You'll see there's an emergency stop switch in front of every door. And you could actually run up to this, punch the button, it would mute the transmitter, you held the button in, and as you released it, it would isolate this section and bring the other two sections back up, and you could maintain...
Oh, so it just went right around it,
You could bypass a section and get in and work on it. To describe this a little bit, there are three RF sections with their own separate door. Of course, you can enter them from the rear as well. They've got big doors. Then you've got two sections that are modulators, and then you've got the final section is the power supply.
Yep.
The idea was that you could take the section offline and work on it as needed and get back up on the air.
Now, each section, it looks like, if these are symmetrical, consisted of three of these panels. The middle panel, where that red kill button is he's talking about, also has water valves on it, so you can control the water in and out of the tubes.
Right, so you can, if you need to get in and change a tube, you can shut that section off. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you notice the wheels that look like big valve handles up above, that's tuning and loading.
Uh-huh.
And those go through long drive shafts to the rear, and there's big gear drives.
Again, custom built, probably.
Custom built.
We're looking at the tubes, which were, they look like 898s, maybe?
I believe that's what they were. Matter of fact, there's one standing right over here. It's made by Federal. This tube,
I
stand 6'3", yeah. 6'4", and this tube hits me mid-chest. Yeah, I'd say 5 feet.
The interesting thing about these old tubes, folks, is the filament leads on these things and the current required just to light the tube was in the thousands of amperes, wasn't it?
Yes, very, very, very high power. Of course, your plate structure is probably the bottom three and a half feet of the tube. And then you have a huge glass, and on the side of the glass is a socket with a connection for your grid. And then, of course, your filament is actually what hooks to the top. It's actually a triode tube.
And the water connections?
What you see next to you is the actual socket for the tube, and the tube actually sets down in this water jacket, and you can see you pumped your water in, up and around the tube.
So the heat is conducted off the plate of the tube, as you discussed it, is a conducting metal, it looks like.
Yes.
And you drop that into a mate here, and it conducts the heat right out and through the... Okay.
Correct.
So that's how they did it.
I don't see a tube type... Oh, here we go. Is this it? Yeah, I think 898 is the correct term. I know there were two different types of tubes, and I think the 898 was the final tube. They had a tube before this that was DC, had DC filaments, and they actually had big motor generators in the basement to actually run the tubes. Then later on, they found that that was inefficient, and they actually got a better tube, and they ran the AC tube and did that up until the time to when they shut the transmitter down. They did, by the way, try to get this transmitter licensed up into the 60s at 625 or 650 kilowatts. And I'm told that that was the power level that the transmitter could modulate to 100% with modern tubes. They were actually going to take the glass tubes out and put in external ceramic.
Really? Yeah. What do you think this room sounded like when this thing was running, and it smelled like, because it had to be ozone going through here?
I'm sure it did. The sound was probably not too bad, because you had a lot of hissing, probably a lot of running water.
Right.
I'm sure you had the pump noise filtering up from the basement. I would imagine the sound of the modulation transformer windings talking. You could hear the station talking quite predominantly. Of course, you had fans and blowers and things, you know, moving air.
And you mentioned earlier that at one time there might have been as many as 13 engineers on duty, so there was probably somebody in here all the time looking at meters.
Correct. Matter of fact, Clyde Hanley told me that one of his duties was to go along with welding goggles and actually look at each tube and make sure that all the filaments were lit.
So again, back to these panels, so you had...
The three panels are about the same for each of the RF sections. You can measure temperature, you can measure water flow. You have two flow meters.
Mm-hmm.
Each flow meter, you have two tubes, so you have two flow meters. And each of those tubes were in parallel. And then to the right, in the same cabinet, were two more tubes, of which they measure the flow. And they measure the water temperature. Those two tubes were operating with the other two tubes in the cabinet in push-pull. So you had two tubes parallel, but they were operating in push-pull.
Right.
With their complementary
buddies. Think of that power.
Yeah.
And there were three of those cabinets.
Three of those cabinets.
Of these tubes online under normal conditions.
Correct.
I wonder what they cost. You ever...
I don't know.
Just think of the electric bill here.
Oh, the electric bill had to be phenomenal.
The stories abound about how all the lights in Mason would dim when they brought this thing up.
Yeah, I'm told that if one of the rectifiers backfired, that they could see it on the switchboards down at CG&E control. Of course, you got to figure this was also in 1933, and you know the power generation facilities were
less stable.
Yeah. I mean they were less stable and not as much of it by any means.
Right. Can we go around the rear?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, we're coming around the back, and now we're looking at...
That is a Faraday shield.
Yeah.
Probably the largest Faraday shield, Faraday screen that you will ever see. Faraday screen eliminates harmonics, is what it's designed to do. You'll notice you have pancake coils on the you have two sets of coils. They're not like a traditional coil wound around a diameter. This coil is flat, and it starts in the middle and winds out towards its outer diameter.
3/4 inch copper, looks
3/4 inch copper tubing, not unlike what you'd, you know, it's almost like a spiral, one of those spiral psychedelic things you used to see on Get Smart or something. But that sort of describes what the coil does. The way they tuned it, that was your tuning. That resonated the circuit. And to do that,
Paul is turning a cog wheel now.
Yeah, there was a crank on the front, and you turned that crank on the front, which turned a gear down here, and actually moved a half-turn loop closer or further away from the pancake coil.
To add inductance to it.
Okay, so you've got your pancake coil. Then you had the Faraday shield, which eliminated harmonic energy. And then on the other side of the Faraday shield, you have another pancake coil that went down to your output network, to your antenna. This unit, as you can see, it is tipped on an angle. And you could actually, by turning
the
control, by changing the coupling, you actually moved the coil closer or further away.
So you're saying the whole 500,000 watts went through the air here for a distance of 8 inches?
Yes.
Oh, my word.
It was capacitively coupled. Of course, you got to remember, this was one-third of 500,000 watts. So.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right.
So,
this
would have been... so we're only talking, you know.
175 or
right,
something.
Right, yeah. Right, exactly. Then you'll notice that everything here is got any metal that terminates doesn't have a sharp point. It's got this large ring on it. It's a corona ring, they're called. And basically, any sharp point you get with high voltage on it will just arc into the atmosphere under a condition called corona. These are done to eliminate that. And there are countless stories that abound, but you can see where people have
touched
it with something to pull them
off. Oh, my goodness, yeah. There's some spots on that copper.
Yes.
So there's three of these, and then there must be a combiner somewhere to bring
the... Yeah, there's a combiner network down in the basement that switched and allowed everything to come together.
Or to operate individually?
Yes. Yeah, right. Okay. Right. Yes.
Boy, the redundancy that was built into this.
Lead line, too.
Now we're getting into the old and the new.
Yes, this is my ham repeater, which it looks like a ham repeater.
What do you tell people is your QTH, the modulator section of a 500 kilowatt? Wow.
And this is our digital link. We have a T1 line that we run audio back and forth between here and our studios in downtown Cincinnati. And one of the things that we were having trouble with was we were getting little glitches in our digital audio, and called the manufacturer, and I told him, I said, well, we're in a pretty high RF field here. He said, would that have anything to do with it? And he said, oh, no. He says, this equipment will run fine up into fields of a volt per meter. I said, that's wonderful, but the field here is about 7 volts per meter. He's like, long pause at the end of the phone. Oh, that could be a problem.
That could be a problem.
So
you put it in here for shielding.
I thought outside of the box, and I said, well, gee, here's a lead-lined room. I'll just stick this equipment in here, and it's worked flawlessly ever since.
Oh, for heaven's sake. Not too many of us can have lead-lined rooms solve that kind of problem.
Yes, indeed.
So that what remains in here is a lot of power divider, big resistors, and some contactors.
Yes, this is some of the low-level power supplies and stuff that actually step the 20 or the lower voltage 240 and 2400 up.
What was the plate voltage on this guy and the current?
Voltage was around 12,000 volts. Yeah. Matter of fact, we can walk out front here. I'll show you the power supply.
So during conditions of 100% modulation, there was 24, 25,000 volts jumping around in this thing, I think. Right?
Oh, yes. Yes, indeed.
Wow. This is really something, folks. And this operated from May 1st or 2nd of 35 through about 1939?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. And actually, it operated during World War II as well. They used it for some... And I'd like to know more about this. I don't know of anybody that does, that at least will talk about it. But I'm told that WLW at night, and I had a friend of mine tell me about this. He's since passed away. Said that he would listen to WLW at night, and he would hear them come on during the war and say a couple words, like just odd, bizarre words, like pelican.
Right.
And he'd say that they'd say it two or three times, then they'd read a text, and then they'd say the word again, and then just continue on with programming like nothing ever happened.
Knowing that that word was being received by the underground in Europe, more than likely.
More than likely.
Or even in the Pacific,
with
the signalist.
Yes. You can see the voltmeter, typically 12.5 kilovolts was where it ran, and power supply typically ran 125 amps.
Talk about a welding.
Yes.
Time meter, 89,455 hours.
Yeah, that's quite a time. That's 10 years.
Yeah, the testing and everything.
Yeah, with the testing.
When it operated at night during the war, was it on as W8XO or?
They actually operated it depended on what they were doing and when they were doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they operated sometimes as W8XO and sometimes as WLW, and so I guess it depended on the era that all this was going on.
Sure.
They also operated shortwave transmitters from here. Actually, they operated shortwave transmitters from here before they did down the road at DuVoice. They operated 6030, which was a propagation transmitter. They operated a couple of rhombic here.
At this site,
yeah.
How much room was that?
There's 32 acres here.
Really?
So there's a pretty good amount of room here.
Well, this tour of the behemoth at Mason, Ohio, pretty well knocked my socks off. WLW 500,000 watts, the only station in the United States to ever operate at that power level. Our thanks to Paul Jellison for this and the rest of our WLW tour. This is Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service, and we'll be back next month to wrap up our tour at Cincinnati. Till then, good listening, DXers. National
Radio Club. Thanks, Mark, for a great tour there of the WLW facilities, and please thank Paul for me. I know Paul through the EAS committee meetings, but Paul has done us a great favor by allowing us to come in and take a tour of the 500,000-watt transmitter. Many people have not had a chance to experience that part of history. I happened to see that when I was attending one of the Harris open house meetings, and that is something that is just absolutely incredible to see. And when you consider that that was put together in the 30s, and they had that thing on the air, I mean, it is just incredible. By the time you get this cassette, the National Radio Club Convention in Dallas, Texas is going to be history. First of all, I'd like to thank John, Bill, and Wally for a great time had by all. If you have not gone to a DX Audio Service National Radio Club convention, you don't know what you're missing. And I'll tell you what, I can speak from experience because at the last minute I had to stay here at home and I wasn't able to attend the convention. However, I was able to listen to a good portion of the webcast while at work, and it was just incredible. The camaraderie and get-together of all the people that you know in the club and the members, editors, I mean, just everyone. And then the speakers that Wally lined up for the convention were just absolutely fantastic. We'll have those speeches, there was two of them, on a edition of All Radio that you'll be able to pick up. And the tours, absolutely fantastic. I'd like to thank the folks at TM and also Hispanic Broadcasting, the ABC studios. I mean, everyone, if you've not gone to a convention, it's time. It is really time for you to start putting your money aside and plan for it. It's going to be in Rochester, New York next year, and we know you're going to have a good time. So start planning for it now, and then you can partake in some of the fun at the National Radio Club Convention. Hopefully, John Malecki will have a convention report on our next edition of the DX Audio Service. John, hint, hint, nudge, nudge. Please get that to us by the 10th of the month so we can put it here in the DX Audio Service. Well, speaking of the convention, I'd like to share with you some of the audio from the business meeting just to let you know what's going on with the club. And you're going to be hearing from Paul Swearingen. This was recorded off the web feed that we had. And I'd like to thank again Wally and the folks at webcasting.com who supplied this feed to the club at no charge. Thanks, guys. So here's what's happening at the business meeting, and we'll see you on side two with more DX stuff.
Well, I think the first order of business ought to be to give a big hand again to our hosts, who tonight have brought us fabulous speakers, and John and Linda for helping with the registrations, and anybody else who had anything to do with it. I had a whole long list of things to talk about, but I'm lying. I just had a few things. But if you have questions, be sure that you ask. I talked to Ken a couple of nights ago, Ken Chatterton, the chairman of the board of directors. He said the club is alive and well, and we've known that. You know, we've got a good monetary base. He said he started mailing out the new logbooks, I think on Tuesday or Wednesday. So if you pre-ordered, you might go home and find a logbook in your mailbox. He is also going to acquire some more FM atlases and sell those. He sold the first 10 out very quickly. He did not give me the price of the logbook, and I neglected to ask him. That's my fault, but it may be exactly the same price as it has been for the last who knows how many years. I'm going to print some information about postage problems or USPS problems. They are cranking down. If you noticed on the last bulletin, there was a address service requested printed there, and what that means is that if you don't upgrade your address, if you move, it's going to cost us 70 cents, and that cost is going to be passed along to you, unfortunately, in the form of one bulletin being cut off the end of your subscription. It's just the fact that the board decided that they were not going to eat the 70 cents per upgrade. In fact, we've had at least five of those come through so far, and that's just the beginning. And the bad news is that it took the first one, I think, 11 days to get back from wherever it was mailed to, and I'm still getting them. And what that means when we go on to weekly bulletins, I think you can kind of see. So I'm just saying to anybody who's listening or out there to make sure that you update your address, your mailing address, when you send it to us. I'm going to be running the contest again. Feel free to enter. There will probably be six people entering, including myself, if past history has anything to do with it. But I'm going to try to make it simple. Ken wanted me to make sure that you understood that there would be some prizes, and $15 to the top winner, $10 and $5 to second and third place, and those can be spent any way you want with the Publication Center, from your subscription to logbook or whatever. Ernie, I think you've got a presentation to make. Come on down. And then I've got one more thing to bring across.
Well, thank you, Paul. This is about the only time I get to be on the camera, rather than come behind it. But anyway, every year, the club gives a plaque to whom the board thinks is the most worthy of helping out with the club. Now, I was surprised. I came here the other day, and I find my picture on page 2 of the handout. Well, I really appreciate that, and I understand that there's somebody in this room that did a lot of work for the club in the past, years ago, but don't think of him being too old. It was a fella who printed by hand the old-fashioned typewriter, the logbook. Now, how would you like to do the logbook today by hand, all done by computer? So I would like the gentleman in the second row from the back with a blue shirt, John Kellerman. Come on. John, the board of directors want to present this to you for their appreciation of your work in the early days of the club.
Well, thank you, Ernie, and thanks to all the club members. And it does this old has-been's heart good to get this from the group of people that I have loved so much for so long. Thank you,
John.
I know it's been the work of John and other past publishers which have really inspired me and kept me going. The last thing that I want to mention is something new. I promised a couple, 3 months ago that there would be some surprises in September, and we're not quite at September yet. What, 15, 16 years ago, the DX Audio Service was established, and that was kind of a spinoff. And hey, I know you guys love it. That was kind of a spinoff from what we'd done besides just publishing DX News. About a year ago, some of us started trading ideas about a third service, and we're going to, although it's not put together totally yet, we're going to start something that'll be a counterpart to the DX Audio Service and DX News. And that will be some kind of a web distribution of DX News. Now, we don't have all the details set up yet. We do know the board has approved for the price of it to be exactly the same as DX News, $28 a year. It will contain almost everything we think that is in DX News, except possibly some of the graphics. We are hoping that many of the foreign members who have dropped out over the years, in fact, we send only one copy to the South Pacific now, and we used to send dozens. We hope that they'll come back and join us through this much cheaper medium, in fact, less than half the price. And we hope that you will join us too if you think that's appropriate for what you want. About 6 or 7 years ago, I said, over my dead body, would this ever happen? And I feel pretty good, so I guess I changed my mind somewhere along the way. But we think it'll be another additional good service of the National Radio Club, and who knows, maybe there'll be others. We have about 680 members of the who receive DX News. I'm not sure of the number. It's over 100 that receive the DX audio service. Anybody know offhand? And so we're in pretty good shape financially, and we hope to keep DXing and having. I'm having fun in Topeka, and I hope you're having fun getting DX News. John, question. Another question.
The new website, this is news to me at least. That sounds great. Why no graphics, and will it have any audio?
Probably no audio, although I can't speak to that. We're still working out the detail. Graphics, if we do present it in PDF, I can tell you that it will not be emailed, as is another famous publication, which there's a gentleman here that handles a lot of that. It will be accessible on the website or on an adjacent website through a password, and that's just to protect the content. The graphics, I honestly do not know how they'll be presented. One thing that we might do in the case of like some of the long, complicated articles, we might say these graphics are available on the original author's website. Some of the pictures that are original with us, we could probably present those if we do a PDF format, portable document format. Some of the mastheads, maybe, maybe not. It'll be more than just straight text-based. And so we're still developing some of that. We've been working on it for a year, and it's kind of up to Fred to come up with the final format of the thing, and he's been awfully busy the last month or two. He's had more on his plate than most of us have in a lifetime. So we're kind of waiting for him to, you know, get things hopping at his end. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Chris.
You mentioned distributing the FM Atlas, and this has been something I've been wanting to see for a number of years, is an AM counterpart to that. I don't think, you know, Bruce Elving would have any interest in doing that. I've been playing around with Publisher and Acrobat, and I'd like to see something like that if just, you know, we're on the road where I can look at the map, say, okay, there's an FM station here, there's a small area there. I'd love to see something like that happen with AM stations, in an 8.5 by 11 format. I'm not sure that I could handle something like that all on my own. Now, I know with the internet, it's possible for several people to work on something like that. Uh-huh. Is there any interest for such a
And I've, you know, thought of something along that line, too. What you would have to do, and this goes for anybody that has a good idea like Chris's, would be to contact Wayne Heinen, who not only works with the log and creates it and sends the masters to Ken for printing, but he also handles the special projects like that. And it's a great idea, and no doubt about it. We also thought way back when that putting the log on disk was a great idea, and then five people bought it. Or 10 or whatever the number was, a very small number of people bought it. Maybe its time had passed, I don't know. Maybe it was like top 40 on AM radio. It was good when they thought of it, and by the time it came out, it had passed. So, you know, any time that you have a good idea like that, contact Wayne, and the board will mull it over and look at the possibilities. So, you know, and I'm not saying yes or no, because I don't make the decision, thank goodness, or we'd still be getting calendars that I created way back when that nobody bought, too. One of my least good ideas, I think.
You just gotta know how to sell them.
That's right. That's right. And all I had was nighttime. What was it? The Times on them that Ernie put out. I guess I wasn't sexy enough. Any other questions? I would propose about a 10-minute break then, for obvious reasons, and we'll try to get the. There will be some grouping, I can tell you for sure. We have over 100 T-shirts, I think, and everybody will walk home with a T-shirt tonight. So, see you in about 10 minutes. National Radio.